Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan. And in for Amy this morning is our friend John Anthony again. John Anthony, former state rep, the host, I should say, of Black and Right Saturdays on our airwaves, Saturdays at 1 p.m. John, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me back, Dan.
Good to have you. And we start this morning with a story right out of a Richard Condon novel, this Matt Gaetz story.
Yeah,
of course, the conservative Trump-supporting congressman from Florida. He is apparently, according to the New York Times, under investigation for an alleged sexual relationship with a 17-year-old girl and transporting her across state crimes, which could implicate federal law. That's the New York Times story. Now, remember, Trump-supporting conservative congressman, so skepticism attaches to the New York Times reporting. Gaetz went on Tucker Carlson's show last night. This broke late yesterday, the story, to explain what exactly this is happening, to address the allegations. And the story got more spy novelish from there. Gaetz first saying the report by the New York Times is a lie.
It is a horrible allegation, and it is a lie. The New York Times is running a story that I have traveled with a 17-year-old woman, and that is verifiably false. People can look at my travel records and see that that is not the case. What is happening is an extortion of me and my family involving a former Department of Justice official. On March 16th, my father got a text message demanding a meeting wherein a person demanded $25 million in exchange for making horrible sex trafficking allegations against me go away. Our family was so troubled by that, we went to the local FBI. And the FBI and the Department of Justice were so concerned about this attempted extortion of a member of Congress that they asked my dad to wear a wire, which he did with the former Department of Justice official. Tonight, I am demanding that the Department of Justice and the FBI release the audio recordings that were made under their supervision and at their direction, which will prove my innocence and that will show that these allegations aren't true. They're merely intended to try to bleed my family out of money. And this former Department of Justice official tomorrow was supposed to be contacted by my father so that specific instructions could be given regarding the wiring of $4.5 million as a down payment on this bribe. I don't think it's a coincidence that tonight, somehow, the New York Times is leaking this information, smearing me, and ruining the investigation that would likely result in one of the former colleagues of the current DOJ being brought to justice for trying to extort me and my family.
So, by the way, his father, the Gaetz family, you know, if you don't know sort of local Florida politics, his father was a state legislator, and he's a big wheel in the panhandle. And I think he's made a decent amount of money in real estate and other ventures.
Okay.
But I mean, on the one hand, the report is that the Department of Justice is investigating Gaetz. On the other hand, the Gaetz family is working with the FBI and by extension the Department of Justice because they're the targets of an extortion plot?
Yes. Release the tapes.
Is that what you think?
Release the tapes because it'll prove what he's saying. I mean, this sounds like something out of Bizarro World, doesn't it?
It is strange. There's no question. It was hard to make heads or tails of it, and I think Tucker was having a difficult time making heads or tails of it as he was talking to Gaetz yesterday. But again, in terms of false allegations here, you know, the quality matters. You don't we must believe the accuser. We must believe the person being accused. No.
Yeah.
We give people the benefit of the doubt based with respect to the story they're telling. And then we start to examine the logic and the evidentiary basis for the story that they're telling. Well, Gates, I mean, he was not shy, as is his wont to not be shy. I mean, he named the guy he says is extorting his family.
His name is David McGee. He was a top official in the leadership in the Northern District of Florida as a prosecutor. He currently works at the Beggs and Lane law firm. As a matter of fact, one of the recordings that was made at the FBI and Department of Justice request occurred at that law firm. And the money that was supposed to be paid today that would have shown even more evidence of David McGee's work in this extortion scheme, that was foiled by the New York Times story. And I believe that's why this horrible information and these terrible allegations have been used this evening.
This is just remarkable. My question, which Tucker didn't ask, would have been, well, then, did you communicate, especially after you just named the guy who was the target of this investigation into an alleged extortion, did you communicate with the FBI, the DOJ, that you were going to come on my show and out him? Because doesn't that basically obstruct the ongoing investigation?
It does. And who tipped off the New York Times? How'd they get the story? Did the DOJ?
That's a fair question. You know, anonymous sources, John. We know how anonymous
sources
especially
from the New York Times and the Washington Post.
Where else would it have come from but other side the inside eye if this was some covert operation? Or if there's, I mean, not the operation because they didn't report on that, but the investigation into Gates.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, this is some sums up with this.
So, and by the way, if one arm of the DOJ is not talking to the other arm of the DOJ, then do we have a competency problem again at Department of Justice and FBI?
I believe so.
We're over here investigating an alleged extortion plot. We're over here investigating the target of the alleged extortion plot. Never the two shall meet? I mean, I don't know. I'm just raising the question. Gates, I mean, he denies it in no uncertain terms, the nature of the reported DOJ investigation that's ongoing.
So they're saying there is a 17-year-old girl who you had a relationship with. Is that true? And who are they? Who is this girl? What are they talking about at the New York Times?
The person doesn't exist. I have not had a relationship with a 17-year-old. That is totally false. The allegation, as I read it in the New York Times, is that I've traveled with some 17-year-old in some relationship. That is false, and records will bear that out to be false.
It can't be any more comprehensive denial, specific denial, right? Yeah. He wasn't evasive.
Right. And I think now the case is on to find this elusive girl. I think that's what they're going to be looking for now.
Well, maybe. I'd also, is somebody going to talk to David McGee over at the law firm? I mean, basically gave out his name, rank, and serial number.
Start there.
How about that? And also, who's ever minding the shop at DOJ? Is that Merrick Garland? Merrick?
Yeah.
You have something to say about Christopher Wray?
He knows. Christopher Wray knows. Anybody knows what about both of the operations, you can't do anything without him knowing.
Well, if you're a congressman, a sitting congressman is a target of or a subject of or both investigations, of course they have to know, don't they?
They have to know. You can't start an investigation without letting the director of the FBI know what's going on.
Are we going to get the we couldn't comment because there's a pending investigation. We don't comment on pending investigations. We're not even going to confirm if there is a pending investigation. We're not going to confirm or deny the New York Times report. Yeah. We're not going to confirm or deny anything that Matt Gaetz said. You'll just have to sit there in the dark and wait to see if and when we come up with something.
The Hunter Biden scandal is a perfect example of Christopher Wray and his incompetence, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah, that's ongoing.
Yeah, it's ongoing. But it happened a year before the election was going on.
I got an idea. Let's appoint John Durham a special investigator.
He is.
He'll get to the bottom of this.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and John Anthony, host of Black and Right, Saturdays 1 p.m. on AM 560, sitting in for Amy this morning, talking about this spy novel that Matt Gaetz is embroiled in. Jim in Crown Point, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
I totally believe this is a smear campaign. Can you not just on based on the fact of Kavanaugh, how they viciously went after him, people out of thin air. And then when he got his nomination, where were the people that continued to go after him? Nobody. It disappears. They don't have the girl's name. They don't have anything. It's amazing.
Thanks for the call, Jim. And, you know, it's interesting. There's this exchange between Tucker and Gates where Gates referenced, you know what it's like to be falsely accused, Tucker. And I had forgotten about that. Tucker was accused of felony rape by a woman, a viewer, I guess, he had never met like 3 or 4 years ago. And he referred to her, Tucker did, as somebody who was mentally ill. Well, clearly, if you're making an allegation like that against somebody you've never met, perhaps that's one of the issues. But anyway, it's just a reminder about, not getting over your skis with respect to allegations that are unverified.
And remember, before Marjorie Taylor Greene, Gates was public enemy number one after Trump.
They
despised this kid.
Oh, yeah. Well, and within Republican ranks, too.
Yes, they despised him.
Right. I mean, don't think that this couldn't happen inside the perimeter if this is at least in part a smear campaign, because, he went after Lynn Cheney.
Yes, he did.
Liz Cheney. Liz Cheney to, be bounced out of
Kinzinger.
House Republican leadership at Kinzinger for voting to impeach Trump. Mm-hmm. Right. So there's, multiple pots where this could be boiling. But the bottom line is, DOJ and FBI need to provide some clarity here.
Release the tapes.
Or if not release the tapes, then give us some description of what, if anything, is happening.
Yeah.
Marvin in Burlington, Wisconsin. Hey, Marvin.
Hi, how are you guys this morning?
Good.
It's trustworthy words and coming from the FBI and the DOJ. See, 4 years, the Durham report. I mean, it's on and on and on. I mean, it's the political smear jobs are done by the Democratic Party because they don't have the facts on their side. And the news media just going along with it. We're still waiting for answers. I mean, the Clinton Foundation, we're still waiting for answers.
Thanks for the call, Marvin.
I mean, is it ever going to end?
I don't know. Thanks for the call, Marvin. But here, the wrinkle here, I don't know if this is a smear campaign or not.
Right.
But the wrinkle here is the allegation of the extortion plot.
Yeah, exactly.
And the name that's provided publicly by Matt Gaetz. I mean, that is just incredible. And if it's an ongoing investigation, they either have to say it's an ongoing investigation or it's not.
Right.
And what is David McGee a target? How's the investigation going now that he's just been outed when you were allegedly monitoring him surreptitiously or trying to get him to admit something on a wire that Matt Gaetz's father was wearing, if that is all true?
What it says to me is that they got something on the tape. That's what it says to me. And I believe that's one of the reasons why Matt Gaetz outed him, because he knows that that guy said something to his father that was incriminating and for the FBI.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, Gaetz clearly believes something on that tape is exculpatory.
I agree.
Yeah.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
You could win $12,000 towards the purchase of a new car or to cover your existing car payments just by doing acts of kindness. Learn more at 560theanswer.com/kindness.
Good morning, Dan, and in for Amy J this morning, John Anthony, host of Black and Right, Saturdays 1 p.m. on these airwaves. And all right, we'll get one more comment on the Gaetz story. By the way, John and I were talking about it during the break, during Mike Scott's newscast, and Gaetz is, he's engaged to Palmer Luckey, the inventor of Oculus VR, the virtual reality thing for Facebook. His sister, Palmer Luckey's sister.
Yes.
You saw him at CPAC.
Yeah, I did. They both were there.
Yeah, it's hard to make sense of
Baffled.
It. I mean, this is what Tucker Carlson said at the end of that interview.
Matt Gaetz interview, that was one of the weirdest interviews I've ever conducted. That story just appeared in the news a couple of hours ago. And on the certainty that there's always more than you read in the newspaper, we immediately called Matt Gaetz and asked him to come on and tell us more, which, as you saw, he did.
Yeah.
I don't think that clarified much, but it certainly showed this is a deeply interesting story, and we'll be following it.
Well, his specifics at least prompted the obvious questions to be asked. Now, whether they get asked and sufficient answers are provided is a separate topic. But he was specific in his denial of the charges, the allegations. He was specific in his assertion about his family's cooperation with the FBI into an alleged extortion plot targeting Matt Gaetz.
Yeah. And even saying that there's no girl.
There's a roadmap.
Right. And even saying that, what 17-year-old girl? There is no 17-year-old girl. Now, if they find that person, I think, no matter what's on the tape.
Yeah, well, right. Producer, I mean, even if you, well, she's got to be older than 17 now. This was a couple of years ago. So producer, is that 17-year-old girl part of the investigation? Did she make an allegation? Did, you know, I mean, all of these questions that you would naturally flow. Yeah. Holly in St. Louis, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, and thanks for taking my call. I watched that last night, and I think Tucker is the gatekeeper now of all future GOP stars. And I felt that when he threw him under the bus twice, Tucker, when he, the second allegation was, you know, you, we were out to dinner. You were out to dinner with me 2 years ago. You know that, you knew, you remember who we were with. Tucker was like, I don't remember that, and I don't know what you're talking about, because he implicated him. And you've been with me before, but Matt Gaetz is a slippery guy. Remember all of a sudden 2 years ago, he's got a son, Nestor, and he announces to the world he adopted when he was a single guy. He adopted this kid. Then suddenly he's engaged to this girl he apparently hadn't been dating that long. And then after posting lots of lit pictures about Tiffany Trump, I mean, Matt Gaetz, I would not want to go long on Matt Gaetz. Did I say that right, in the gambling world?
Yes, well, or the stock world, yes, which is the gambling world, I suppose. Yes.
I'm selling short today, Matt Gaetz.
Thanks for the call. I mean, we mentioned that about the son,
Nestor.
I'm not living and dying by Matt Gaetz either. These people that are designated as rising stars in the Republican Party because they're outspoken, regardless of the quality of their outspokenness, that's not how my barometer. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, that's true.
Your appearance on Fox News doesn't mean anything to me.
Yeah. I agree there.
But that's not to say that. And by the way, Tucker didn't really throw him under the bus. The back and forth they had about, you know, we were out to dinner a couple of years ago. You remember the girl that I was with? And Tucker was like, I don't remember that woman. So he wasn't like, oh, that dinner never happened.
Right.
He's just saying, oh, I don't remember. So, you know, whatever. And Tucker did cop to Matt Gaetz saying, you know what it's like to be falsely accused. And he recounted how he was falsely accused. Again, this isn't passing judgment on the quality of what Gaetz is saying, but he was specific. And so now he's given a story that can be checked out in a way that most slippery politicians don't when they're trying to hide something. So he is either, I mean, wildly reckless in terms of like saying, here is my story. Here's the guy who's extorting me. The girl doesn't exist. I've never had a relationship with a 17-year-old girl. This is what's going on. And you can go ask somebody. Okay, he's put it out there.
Yeah, but the burden, I think, is on the DOJ and the FBI. The burden is there. I don't think the burden is on Matt Gaetz because they were investigating both aspects of this case.
Allegedly.
So
we don't know.
The burden of proof is on them to produce something.
I think Gaetz has a responsibility as an elected official to respond.
Correct. Which he's done.
Yeah. And again, there's no equivocation here. There's no, you know, I'm sorry if you were offended type of response. Yeah. This is. Or, you know, I don't recall.
Right.
This is like, that person doesn't exist. I've never had a relationship. So if there is an investigation, which he may not be aware of, then there's no basis for it. And oh, by the way, here's this other investigation that I do know is ongoing because my family's a participant, a cooperating participant with the FBI.
That's just crazy.
It seems like this could all be fleshed out pretty quickly.
Really quickly. Mike, produce the tapes.
Mike in Union, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen. I think the reason he named names is the FBI is not going to do anything about it. They're going to hide it. They're not going to release anything. I mean, let's remember who's in charge of the DOJ and FBI right now. So this will go nowhere. They'll leave the allegation out, and Adam Schiff will have an investigation to, throw him out of Congress here pretty soon.
Yeah.
And the media will go right along with it.
Well, to your
point, fellas.
Thanks, Mike. To your point, Ted Lieu from California has already called on Gaetz to be removed from committee. I mean, the same party that has no problem with Eric Swalwell being right. on Homeland Security.
I kind of disagree with that caller. I think because it's a Republican, they can get a lot of media out of this. They're gonna milk this for as much as they possibly can. Especially because it's Matt Gaetz, the Republican.
I suspect you're right, and but here's the issue. You're not going to be able to get away with just trying to go after Gaetz, you know, in the arena of the press, and not address the allegations that Gaetz made right. about this extortion plot against him and his and by extension his family.
Yeah, that's fair.
So we'll see on that. All right, I want to get to, you know what? Let's get to this other topic too. You mentioned yesterday, and we didn't have time to get to it, John, but Waukegan, Dateline Waukegan, Illinois, for our latest story in The Purge. Now, this is the typical Illinois story where the entire debate is between different factions of the Cultural Marxist Party.
Yeah.
Okay. There's no participation from anybody sensible here. So Thomas Jefferson Middle School in Waukegan. Well, obviously that should be renamed because Thomas Jefferson was a bad person.
Correct.
The author of the Declaration of Independence, right? And so then he should be replaced by Barack Obama. It should be Barack Obama Middle School because Barack Obama is the greatest intellect that the West has ever produced. He was the greatest president in the history of the United States. He was the greatest world leader who ever lived. He's a Nobel Peace Prize winner. He is basically descended from heaven.
You missed one.
To Illinois.
Greatest slick oil salesman as well. You missed that one.
Well, that's you saying it. I'm just repeating what Illinois thinks. So obviously that would be a perfect name to adorn Thomas Jefferson Middle School in Waukegan. Uh-oh. Identitarian infighting.
The deporter-in-chief presidential is today still President Barack Obama. He did the most deportations in the history of our nation.
That's Julie Contreras, part of a group of Waukegan residents, some of whom are former students who are pushing for not naming a local school after former President Barack Obama. Tonight, they made their feelings known to the school board at WPS 60.
Today, I want to urge the school board to drop the names of Barack and Michelle Obama from consideration. Barack Obama's presidency was filled with hostility against the immigrant community. According to the Department of Homeland Security, the Obama administration deported a record number of 3,066,457 people, the largest amount of deportations under any sitting president.
The school in question is currently named after founding father Thomas Jefferson. The desire to change the name is being driven because Jefferson was a slave owner. So why not Barack Obama Middle School? Because Contreras and her group did not believe the former president should receive such status in Waukegan and its majority Latinx population.
Latinx.
Because of the former president's record on immigration, she says. Some Waukegan residents had experience with agents from ICE during the 44th president's administration.
Those children live in the reality of insecurity in mixed status families. And for us, having the deporter-in-chief's name is painful.
Favorite word in that clip we played, John, Latinx yeah. or mixed status
yeah.
family.
What's that?
Some are here
I've
legally,
heard Latinx.
Some are not here legally.
Oh, there you go.
Mixed status.
Yeah. I mean, 2.5-3 million people, I should say. You know, that really wasn't talked about during the campaign, was it? And who was a part of that administration? Uncle Joe, right?
Right. Joe Obama's third term is
yeah,
what we're in now.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're in right now.
Yeah. So what should Thomas Jefferson Middle School be renamed? Obviously, it should be renamed. We can't have anything named after any of our founding fathers. Should it be Barack Obama or should it be another Marxist? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. And I don't want anybody calling in saying Jack Benny Middle School. Not hearing it.
Peter Frampton.
Well, Jack Benny was actually Waukegan
yeah,
resident.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey.
You know.
It works.
What about the any? Here's another thought, though, too. You know, I hate to see identitarians infighting. Maybe to just avoid all this ugliness, we could have Lori Lightfoot send some, you know, the machinery normally reserved for Grand Park up to Waukegan, pull the sign up, put it away for safekeeping, put the Barack Obama sign in.
There you go.
And then, you know, maybe the two women that Patrick Elwood interviewed over there at WGN, I guess it was the one woman and then the guy who spoke before the school board, maybe they'll be a little bit upset. But then soon enough, everybody will forget about it and get up on their business.
But did you hear he said Barack and Michelle? What did Michelle Obama do, though? I'm saying. But she wasn't one of the ones that deported them, is what I'm saying.
Oh, you mean so Michelle Obama.
Right. Then, Michelle
Obama's a compromise candidate.
There you go.
And the school lunch program. I think maybe they have the school room or the lunchroom named after Michelle Obama because for the school lunch program.
Oh, yeah, the Go program, the Move or Go.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. On the go, on the move.
You sure?
Something like that.
I'm trying to think. Let's see. No Jack Benny. Can't do Jack Benny. I know that. He's just an old white guy.
Yeah. I mean, who's from Waukegan that we can name it after? Cesar Chavez.
He's not from Waukegan, I don't believe. Otto Graham.
Oh.
Sure. You know, I went to Northwestern. Standout athlete.
You sure there's no cancel culture that they can find something and cancel him? I'm sure they can find something in Otto Graham. You know, I mean, if you're white.
I think he played for the New York Giants. Did he spend any time with the Cleveland Browns?
Oh, that may disqualify him.
Yeah,
maybe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Bill in LaSalle County here in Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning. I was going to suggest a couple of famous admirals since it's next to Naval Base. Admiral Farragut or Admiral John Paul Jones, but we could also, if we're looking to have an ethnic flair to it, how about Master Diver Carl Brashear from the Navy, the gentleman who lost his leg in that recovery of the nuclear bomb at the bottom of the sea?
Men of Honor, the movie, yeah. Men of Honor with Cuba Gooding Jr., Robert De Niro.
I found one.
Wait, but was Brashear from Waukegan?
I don't believe so, but you know what? Since we're making it about identity, and the Navy base, that would be a perfect one.
Yeah, but the problem, Bill, is that Carl Brashear was in the armed services, and that's an oppressive institution. I mean, at least until they go full identitarian. They're trying, but right now they're still warmongers probably like, and remember, there's this problem with white supremacy in the military, according to Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin.
I found one.
Who?
Juan Rivera. He was wrongly convicted of the 1992 murder of Holly Staker in Waukegan. That fits the crime. That fits the bill that they're looking for.
Okay.
There you go.
All right. See? Yeah, I think it should be somebody in Waukegan. You know,
he's from Waukegan.
Juan Rivera.
Yeah, he's from Waukegan.
He was
wrongfully convicted of the 1992 murder of Holly Staker in Waukegan.
I don't remember that. Did he have a criminal background?
Yeah, well, that he did. Mm. Yeah, and he's Puerto Rican. Well, you know, I mean, that's what they're looking for, Latinx. You know,
Puerto Rican is American.
Well,
where the mixed status families may not feel comfortable enough with somebody who enjoys the benefits of an American.
I'll keep looking.
Keep looking. I don't think that's good enough. Tom in Deer Park.
Go there at 2 in the morning, put an X on the school.
Ooh.
Demolish it the next day. Continue to pay the teachers. Demolish the school. Airbrush it from history. It didn't happen. No more dead white guys, no nothing. Case closed.
All right. Well, thanks, Tom. Wait, well, but then you're going to have to replace it with like a statue of somebody, maybe just like a big Black Lives Matter sign or Latinx Lives Matter, or I don't know what a phrase that those people who use phrases like mixed status want there in the public square.
Yeah, that's not a lot of people from Wisconsin.
You know,
that are not white.
From Waukegan.
Yeah, Waukegan. I mean, I'm sorry.
Yeah, there's the obvious play. Consistent with the times and with the disposition of Waukegan and the entire Chicagoland area, but Waukegan, since we're talking about Waukegan, Ray Bradbury.
Oh.
You know, his dystopian novel, Fahrenheit 451, perfect representative of the time. But, again, he was white, so that's a problem.
Yeah.
Brian in Evergreen Park.
Yeah, I think they should name it after Cesar Chavez because it puts him in a bind. You know, he's Latinx. But he was anti-illegal immigration, and he was someone who was an American who actually, worked on a farm. Mm. And he was a union guy, so that checks a lot of boxes for him, but it also goes against the reason they don't want Barack Obama.
Yeah, I'd rather go with Julio Cesar Chavez, the great welterweight. Ralph and Rantoul.
Good morning. I think all public education should be permanently and immediately put under the directorate eye for indoctrination, and then all buildings are just referred to as the number. And as far as the statues out front, all of them, get rid of all of them. Replace them all with just generic blocks of concrete.
Sure. Thanks for calling. Like the photo that comes, you know, when you buy a frame, just that generic insert you get.
Keep it there.
That's what we should have. Let's not honor anybody in America anymore.
I think I found the perfect person now. He's black.
So this is for the name of the school.
For the name of the school. Right. He's black. Mm-hmm. He played basketball. He won an NBA championship. Sean Marion played for the Dallas Mavericks. See, there
Sean Marion's from Waukegan?
He's from Waukegan, Illinois.
Really?
Yes, he is.
Why didn't I know that?
There it is. Perfect. I mean, come on. I mean, he fits all of the categories.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's famous.
Not bad. I was going to go with, I was going to suggest, you know, I was waiting to see what people came up with. Sean Marion's pretty good, though. And I would say, like, here's somebody everybody could love. And you get, you know, bring the community together. Waukegan native, Jerry Orbach from Law and Order.
Yeah. Oh.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a unifying figure. His witticisms
on
Law and Order.
What's his politics, though?
I don't know. He went to Northwestern. He's probably left. Larry and George, Larry and Elmhurst, I was going to say. Sorry. I almost stole
your good morning. Yeah. Hey, you know, that's a no-brainer. It should be George Floyd School, man. Come on.
All schools? Yeah. Thanks, Larry. Yeah.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan, and in for Amy J is John Anthony, host of Black and Right on AM560, these airwaves, Saturdays, 1 p.m. You want to check that out if you haven't been listening.
Thanks for having me, man.
Of course, yes. And John, I don't know if you can make the time, but I will.
Okay.
Saturday, April 10th. It's the week after Easter weekend, if you observe such things.
I do.
3 p.m. at the corner of A1A and Las Olas in Fort Lauderdale.
Oh.
It's going to be a bit of a hike.
Yeah, that's
it's not just like coming from Joliet.
No.
Million maskless march and mask burning in Fort Lauderdale on Saturday, April 10th at 3 p.m.
Let me book my flight.
Exactly. Talk about, tourist travel for a specific purpose. A business or pleasure? A little bit of both.
Yeah, and it's warm. Warmer here, warmer there than it is here. So,
this is, along the lines. I mean, DeSantis isn't given to rhetorical excesses, but Governor DeSantis in Florida is very straightforward about what he is going to support and what he's not going to support and why. I know he has been treated by the left, by the enlightened class, like the Lightfoots and the Pritzkers,
yeah,
as some sort of
Gretchen Whitmer's
backwater rube.
Yeah.
Hardly. And this is what he had to say at a presser this week about vaccine passports. We touched upon a little bit yesterday, but let's dig into it.
So there was never under discussion any mandates to take vaccines. We will not have COVID vaccines mandated in Florida. The flip side of that, though, with these vaccine passports is it's completely unacceptable for either the government or the private sector to impose upon you the requirement that you show proof of vaccine to just simply be able to participate in normal society. You want to go to a movie theater? Should you have to show that? No. You want to go to a game? No. You want to go to a theme park? No. So we're not supportive of that. I think it's something that people have certain freedoms and individual liberties to make decisions for themselves. I also wonder, it's like, okay, you're going to do this, and then what, give all this information to some big corporation? You want the fox to guard the hen house? I mean, give me a break. I think this is something that has huge privacy implications. It is not necessary to do.
The liberty arguments, the privacy arguments, are those compelling to you? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Before answering, consider some pushback from, you know, generally speaking, a libertarian-leaning friend of individual liberty. That's Scott Adams, the Dilbert cartoon creator, who's become quite outspoken during the pandemic. We've had him on the show a couple of times. Well, on his Periscope, or I guess, you know, that's what he does mainly. Mm-hmm. He tackled some of the arguments against vaccine passports, which he is open-minded to supportive of. So on the liberty argument, here's Scott Adams's response.
It's discrimination against the free will of the people who do not want to get vaccinated. Is that true? Would it be discriminating against, we'll say the freedom, I think is the point, the freedom of the people who do not want to get vaccinated? That's true. It definitely discriminates against their freedom. But isn't that true of a driver's license? Isn't that true of getting a loan? People who don't have tax returns can't go on. Isn't it true of travel? You can't travel anywhere unless you have a passport. So this is a true statement. It discriminates against your freedom. But that's not a reason, because we do it all the time. So the society, all of civilization, the entire civilization is built on restricting your freedom. That's what it is. You don't build a civilization to give people freedom. All of civilization is a restriction of freedom. And it's designed to be a wise restriction. It restricts the things that you'd want to restrict. This is just another one of them.
And so it needs to be assessed in that context. Is this a wise restriction? As I said, Scott Adams seems to be fairly supportive of a vaccine passport. What about you, and what about responding to the liberty argument the way that he did? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636-DA, turnkey.pro.
But this is my health. We're talking about you knowing, the public or government officials knowing about me having a vaccine for something that's 99.9% curable. I mean, isn't that the baseline of the argument? And or should it start there first? This is a 99.9% curable virus, Dan. Now, I get it that it affects some more than others, just like H1N1. It affected kids instead of the elderly. We didn't talk about having vaccine passports then. No. Going to another country, I get it. I don't belong to that country. But to travel anywhere in America, I don't need a passport to go anywhere in America. I mean, I'm telling you, you know how you know China is taking over our country? Because we're taking the exact same steps they did and how they rule over their people.
So address the comparison he makes to a driver's license, to a bank loan. What was the other one he made? A passport just to travel in general. Yeah, those three comparisons to a vaccine passport. Is there something very different about a vaccine passport from those other examples that he used to as comparisons?
Well, you know, when you look at it from the perspective of having a driver's license to drive a car, well, I mean, you're dealing with a vehicle that can potentially hurt somebody that you can get hurt within this vehicle. And you're driving out on the street. Do you understand how to drive? That's what a driver's license says to the rest of to you as you're out on the road. That this guy has taken the necessary steps to understand how to operate this vehicle. But
but there's something fundamentally different about a driver's license than a vaccine passport.
Yeah.
What's that fundamental difference?
312-642-5600,
turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. There's something fundamentally different about a vaccine passport and a bank loan. There's something fundamentally different about a vaccine passport and a passport. What is it?
Government.
You're warm. Candace in Mount Pleasant.
You don't even protect children in this country from abortion, pedophiles, murderers coming in across the border, but something that is 99.8% curable. Oh, we have to have a vaccine for that. I am never getting that vaccine, and I have prohibited my husband. I told him, if your company tells you have to get it, you will be quitting your job, because that apparatus It's not coming into my household. And I mean it.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks for the call, Candace. We know who wears the pants in Candace's family. I'm just kidding. Okay, I get it. I get why people are exercised. But the difference. We've got to address the arguments that are made, especially by otherwise, I mean, I don't have to say he's not being thoughtful, but by, let me just say it, by thoughtful people like Scott Adams. Let's address the arguments that he's making. Kyle in Oak Lawn.
Hi, I just would figure HIPAA would be applicable to something like this. I mean, I thought you couldn't ask questions regarding personal health. Have a good day.
Thanks for the call, Kyle.
I said that yesterday. You know, I mean, every argument, nobody's arguing the HIPAA laws. You know, I see that even with the Naomi Wolf article, I didn't see anything talking about HIPAA. The Biden, when he talked about the vaccine passport, still nothing about HIPAA.
So let's throw HIPAA and privacy in together okay. as another argument that needs to be addressed. And so so essentially the platform that would be created to have the vaccine passports. Scott Adams addressed the privacy platform argument.
So the problem is that once you have a platform, and this is Dr. Naomi Wolf's argument, that once you have a platform where there's something about you, in this case the vaccination or not, is in the database, and that's going to restrict you from, let's say, businesses or travel or government things, once you have that system, they can add anything to that system, can't they? They can add anything to that. Next thing you know, maybe the next thing they add to it, you don't like so much, even if you think the vaccination thing's a good idea.
Wow. Okay, so that's the setup, and here's the pushback.
Do you know what else could be expanded into a social credit system? Any database. It's just a database. Yes, you can put bad things in a database. You could put good things in a database. But you don't get rid of databases because somebody could misuse it. So could somebody misuse this system? Yes. They could misuse every system. That's not a reason not to do it. You have to weigh the risk against the benefits, right?
So is that what the privacy / platform is, just a risk-benefit analysis? So that's the second question. And my other question still pending. The comparison he made to a vaccine passport to a regular passport, to driving, driver's license, to a bank loan. Address either one, please. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. Bob in Edison Park.
Yeah, real quick about the bank loan. That's a private industry giving you money or investors money. So I think the bank loan is really a bad argument. The other thing is, rather than say, well, we have all these restrictions on our freedom, so another one really isn't that bad, I would say, well, maybe we should look at these things that are already restricting our freedom and do away with some of those. And one other issue, you know, these so-called conservatives like him, and then the other day you had that George Will on. George Will, Mr. Constitution, he was backpedaling on this issue. And this author, this cartoonist, he's right. If they start this, it will not. And he goes, well, because it might be abused. Well, that's a big might, because it will be abused. We've seen these things abused through time and immemorial.
Thanks for the call, Bob. Good points. He addressed the abuse, saying market forces and transparency would address the abuse. In other words, if you couldn't get into a movie theater but for a vaccine passport, there would be people who didn't get the vaccine, don't have the vaccine passport, that would protest, and that would incentivize at least perhaps some movie theater or movie theater chain to allow people who don't have the vaccine passport. And then, you know, will the pendulum swing back to those who do and they want everybody to have vaccine? We don't know. But he market forces and transparency is his argument in terms of how you'll achieve a societal balance on this issue of vaccine passports and access.
I'm curious to your answer to that first question, though. I'm sitting over here like, come on. What is that answer?
Well, I'm going to let other people weigh in first. We must be patient, John. The other John, the one in Florence, Wisconsin.
Yeah, well, a driver's license is a privilege, not a right.
Sure.
And, you know, we always talk about your freedom of expression. You have the right to express yourself until your hand extends itself and touches the tip of my nose.
Right.
So that's one of them. But, I mean, this slippery slope, which we just love and I love, I mean, this is right out of Mel Brooks' thing. This is, the papers, can I see your papers, please? Mm-hmm. papers, okay, shoot them.
That's what's going to happen.
Pretty good, John. Thank you. Thank you for going in character. We appreciate that. Really drives it home. Gene in Lake Zurich.
Yeah, so this is one virus that's going to be on there. Or are they going to add the vaccine for measles, which is probably a worse disease? What else can they add to this passport?
Well, I mean, Adam, thanks for the call. Adams concedes the point. They can add bad things. I mean, a la the Chinese communists.
Yeah.
They could add anything under the sun, including perhaps if you've committed a thought crime or a social media crime, that you've run afoul of the minders, right? I mean, that's the sort of thing that can travel around with you, like it does these days, social media postings. Yeah. How many examples have we had of this, where social media postings and as a condition of employment or as something that knocks you out of an employment opportunity?
But I think that isn't that the ultimate goal, though, where they can track basically everything about you? I mean, your face, your social media posts, your bank account. What I think China calls it the social credit.
Yeah, combine it all into a credit score.
Everything. I mean, but
all are equal, but some are more equal than others. It's Animal Farm.
The one thing you never do, you never open up a door to a politician on anything. Taxes. I mean, no matter what it is, once you've opened up the door, once they've gotten that incremental inch, they'll bust open the door, and it'll never be the same. And I think that's what will happen with this.
Right. A bank loan is other people's property. The roads are everybody's property, so they're lorded over by the state. Air travel is private property. You know, the planes are private. So the comparison actually would be they have dominion over their property, and I have dominion over mine. You know what my property is?
Mm.
Me.
Yeah.
That's
simple.
The pushback to Scott Adams.
God.
In addition to he recognizes the danger, so it's not like he's oblivious to it. But you're right. It's like, oh, every system can be abused. Yes, no, I know every system can be abused, but it's abused at a mass scale when you allow the purveyors of a monopoly force of power that abuse. And why would you want to provide that avenue? So to Scott Adams, the standard he wants to apply, cost benefit. Do the benefits of effectively requiring vaccines by mandating vaccine passports for people that are unlikely to get sick and die, and you're mainly protecting them against themselves?
Yeah.
Does that outweigh the societal costs that are immediate? And those potential societal costs that are difficult to quantify.
Yeah.
And the answer is, according to his cost benefit analysis, it's not even close.
Wow. You know, I look at this. I just don't get how many people are willing to just open themselves up. And how is it not racist to mandate a vaccine passport, but it's racist to mandate a voter ID?
Well,
hey, I mean, come on. It's...
Of course. Yes. When it comes to, you know, identification, the left is very specific and very narrow in their concern. There's no question about that. And also, the safetyism mindset. I mean, and how committed these purveyors of agitprop are. How committed they are to propagating their agitprop. You want to get a sense of it, the depth of it.
Wow.
Major, you know, the Biden's dog, Major, who got banished because he nipped somebody. Well, he's back and he just nipped somebody else.
Oh, God. Secret Service, right?
Another biting incident that required medical attention. Listen to the statement from First Lady Jill Biden, not a doctor, his press secretary, Michael LaRosa. Yes, Major nipped someone on a walk. Out of an abundance of caution, the individual was sent by White House medical unit, seen by White House medical unit, and then returned to work. Out of an abundance of caution, that phrase that is used to justify everything under the sun, every restriction under the sun with respect to COVID. Here we go. You talk about a dog bite, yeah, and they have to continue to force their nomenclature on the public.
It's true.
Everything is done out of an abundance of caution, out of an abundance of caution, out of an abundance of caution, out of an irrational overabundance of caution. But they want you to believe there's no such thing. And there is. Bill on the Northwest side.
Good morning, Dan and John. I think that if we have a federal mandate for vaccines, and Mr. Scott invoked the integrity of databases as being an integral part of this process, I think stretching that to voter IDs is very reasonable, because you talk about protecting your body, protecting the roads, protecting your privilege to drive, et cetera, et cetera. What about protecting your freedom, your constitution, by requiring voter IDs? You know, I don't think it's that unreasonable at all. If they go with the vaccine passport, they should go with federally mandated voter ID in-person voting with exceptions for disabled people, et cetera. Thank you for taking the call.
Thanks for the call, Bill.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and John Anthony, host of Black and Right, Saturdays 1 p.m. on these airwaves, in for Amy this morning.
You got me that last segment.
I did?
Because I know you always make the complex simple, and I should have looked to the simple and not the complex.
You should have. That was your mistake.
Yeah, that was my big mistake.
You are still learning, young grasshopper.
I am.
But we will get there. Now, wax on, wax off.
Okay.
All right. How about see if you can get this one? This is a little easier. Is she right? The deputy mayor of Paris, Audrey Pulvar. People who suffer discrimination for the same reasons and in the same way all feel the need to meet among themselves to discuss it. They can, however, be asked to be. And when white people come to those meetings, they can come to the meetings. They can, however, be asked to keep quiet and be silent spectators. Yeah. So only people of color can address issues of discrimination against people of color. Is that right?
No. This whole people of color, I mean, black people are really upset about being, you know, everybody's now being lumped in with black and then, you know, black, Asian, Latino. I mean, black people are black people, and they'll tell you that. They're really frustrated with being lumped in with people of color.
Are your standard issue off-the-shelf white guys like me, are we allowed to talk about black people? I don't know. It seems like it'd be difficult not to. If we're not, then we're not being anti-racist like Ibram Kendi tells us to be.
Right.
Don't we have to fight racism? At the same time, they tell us, shut up. They say, where's your voice?
Acknowledge it. Right, right. Exactly.
So I'm a little perplexed. I'm not really, because they're not really honest brokers. They don't really want my opinion, and they really do want me to shut up. Really what they want is for people like me to shut up and also to accept being called a racist.
Pretty much, yeah. And remember, don't forget the most important part.
Yeah.
Your white privilege.
Well,
don't forget
right.
that part.
No, I know.
That's more important than you being called a racist.
I can't forget it, because they're going to tell me all about it.
Every single day.
And then I'm supposed to just regurgitate it on an assignment in my high school class at Loyola Academy in Wilmette. By the way, that story got picked up by Fox News, so now it's national.
Oh, nice. I saw that.
Glad Fox News picked it up. The parents at Loyola, see, you made a difference. Sensible people who spoke up, you made a difference. It is possible. So keep the pressure on that ghastly group of, I don't know, anti-Catholic Jesuits that apparently are running Loyola Academy in Wilmette. It's stunning. But I read that story about this, you know, daffy deputy mayor of Paris and her, you know, white people, you're allowed to attend, but just sit there quietly and listen to why you're bad. Okay. Oh, yes, ma'am. And I couldn't help but think of C.S. Lewis. So I went back and read the Screwtape Letters.
Oh, I love that book.
Mm-hmm. For those of you who haven't familiarized yourself with the Screwtape Letters, please do so post haste. And they're just it's so applicable. I mean, C.S. Lewis was such a genius because he was able to translate the truth of the Bible, into a socio-cultural political context. And that's in part what the Screwtape Letters are, Screwtape writing to his protege Wormwood, mm-hmm. about how to best corrupt men.
Yes.
That's the book, if you haven't read it. And, I mean, he's so prescient, C.S. Lewis, who was referred to, you recall, by Joy Behar, noted intellect.
Oh, there we go.
Joy Behar, one of those man-hating shrews on that View show, as a children's book author. That's how she understood C.S. Lewis. Remember, Sarah Palin was asked when she was a VP candidate with McCain, who's your favorite author? She said C.S. Lewis. And Joy Behar was like, the children's book author?
Oh, my goodness.
And so I was thinking about C.S. Lewis and Screwtape Letters, and then and that led me to thinking about Joy Behar, and that led me to thinking about, why is The View on the air? Why is that show? And this is, I mean, it could be in any number of shows, but since Joy Behar made that just epic comment about C.S. Lewis, I'll start with The View. Why is Joy Behar and the entire panel, even as it's changed over time, and including Meghan McCain, why is it on the air?
I think they're a big propaganda piece for any and everything. You want to get a topic out in the atmosphere. All you got to do is talk about it on there, and you know, I mean, because and they try to bring in the right perspective with Meghan McCain, but she's just the biggest part of the propaganda with them as well.
Mm-hmm. But what does it reflect? Somebody who
culture.
Thinks. What does it reflect? Somebody who thinks C.S. Lewis is a children's book author and that's all he is. What is that? And she has a show because she's so funny. And I mean, she has a show along with Whoopi Goldberg, who's just so funny. They're just so sassy and funny. Is that it? Is that why you think they have the show? Because they're so talented.
No, that's not
they're
it.
Talented conversationalists. They're compelling. Is that why you think they have a show?
No, see, you need to watch them while you're in that parish room being told how guilty of a white man you are.
Yeah, I know, but, you know, it's funny. I'm sure that the show has got good ratings. I'm sure it makes a lot of money. They all get paid a lot of money. So it's like, oh, it's just you know, what the market wants.
Yeah. That's our culture. That's where we're at.
That's partly true. But, you know, for those in that industry who have a political agenda, and of course they all do because they were raised to be political activists regardless of their profession. They were educated to be political activists regardless of their profession, so that's what they're doing. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how you construct a panel like they've constructed.
Good point.
So why is it on the air? Well, go to Screwtape Letters. C.S. Lewis has the answers. He normally does. Screwtape telling his fellow devils, this is in the Screwtape proposes a toast.
Yes.
Right? He tells them, democracy is the word with which you must lead them by the nose. Mm. The basic principle of the new education is to be that dunces and idlers must not be made to feel inferior to intelligent and industrious pupils. That would be undemocratic. The new education. Dunces and idlers must not be made to feel inferior to intelligent and to the intelligent and the industrious. Because that's undemocratic.
So they're there to dull our senses and sensibilities, basically what you're saying.
They're there to reinforce what the dunces and idlers believe to be true.
Yeah.
They are dunces and idlers. They know nothing. Joy Behar knows nothing of any importance, as so encapsulated by the comment about C.S. Lewis. They're the people, whatever is in my head is the truth. I don't have to bump it up against anything. There's nothing that exists outside me that I need to reflect upon. And that's the same thing as their audience. And so they serve as a reinforcement mechanism for the idlers and the dunces, not to mention, think about what time it's on during the day.
Yeah, true, yeah. 10 o'clock, right? 10 o'clock is our time.
What, you know, for housewives and radio talk show hosts who have morning shows. Yeah. That's the only people around to watch it.
Wait, are you admitting to watching it?
No, I'm not. Or those, you know, they're just the idlers and the dunces. Screw tape, again. At universities, examinations must be framed so that nearly all the students get good marks. Entrance exams must be framed that way so that all or nearly all citizens can go to universities, whether they have any power or wish to profit by higher education or not. Children who are fit to proceed to a higher class may be artificially kept back because the others would get trauma by being left behind. Oh, trauma. You'd be doing violence. Isn't that the language of the day? Everything is a trauma and everything is violence.
Yes.
Can't keep anybody artificially back because somebody might get a trauma. What have we seen over the last half a century with social promotion in K through 12 and frankly at the university level and the grade inflation at both levels?
It's hurt us big time.
This is C.S. Lewis, writing half a century ago, more. And it's all come to pass. And we don't stop and go, well, why are we seeing that? Why is that being elevated? Why is that so popular? Why these change in policies? Why this change in approach to education and the dulling of the American mind? Forget the closing of it, the dulling of it.
Yeah,
it's not open or closed. It's just sort of a perpetual null state.
I'm going to go read this book again. It's been 10 years since I read it.
They're there to, they know nothing. They're there to make you feel good about knowing nothing and having no interest in learning anything.
That's a good point.
Mike in Downers Grove.
I got a solution to all this racism crap.
Okay.
Okay. Here's the idea. Everybody has to have their DNA tested for 23andMe. And whenever you bring up the subject of race, everybody has to disclose what they really are, including their Neanderthal variants. And black people will find out that they're not all black unless they actually came from South Africa recently. Mexican people will find out that they're partially Indian. White people will find out generally that they're descended from Neanderthals.
Yeah.
And then the heck with this.
Except that I mean, that means nothing to the identitarians, you understand.
Right. But the whole point is once you start discussing this openly and deciding that nobody is really anything that they think, you know, it becomes a whole new world.
No, it doesn't. Thanks for the call, Mike. No, why won't it?
Because, I mean, I agree with you. I'm agreeing with you because I took the ancestry DNA test, found out I'm 54% European. I'm more European than I am black. Uh-huh. But I grew up thinking I was black and Puerto Rican. And I know white friends of mine who have taken the test, and they have sub-Saharan Africa. They have South African blood, Nigerian blood. But guess what? None of it matters to other people, to other black people. Because guess what? When they look at them, all they see is white people.
Well, yeah, and here's the other thing. Here's why it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter even if you look black, you have darker skin, but you turn out to be majority. It doesn't matter if you're majority black and you look more white.
Yeah.
This is about claims to power.
It's true.
Through race. So it doesn't matter. Rachel Dolezal, Sean King. They're white people.
Yeah.
You think it matters?
No.
This is about claims to power. And so the truth of someone's racial composition makes a difference to the Marxists, the cultural Marxists and the identitarians. I repeat myself. No, it doesn't. I mean, you cannot start from the premise that they are interested in the truth.
Right.
You have to tell the truth. I mean, I appreciate Mike's point about, you know, giving people who are fair-minded a broader understanding of just how mixed up we all are. And that's only going to increase with the This was the point, one of the points of Eli Steele's documentary, How Jack Became Black. I think when he did the documentary, like 14% of American couples were multiracial or biracial, yeah. And that's only going to increase. So then you would think, well, that's just going to dissipate, and thank God for that. But it's not going to dissipate because this is about politics and power. It's not about a deeper, more textured understanding of race and people's heritages.
And they'll never accept it. Just knowing that you have African blood, they cannot accept that because of that thirst for that power you speak of.
Maida in Lake of the Hills.
Yes, hi. First, thank you so much for you guys. Man, love you. When you were talking about C.S. Lewis, first of all, it just made me think nothing new under the sun.
Yeah.
Just nothing
yeah.
new. Think of how long it was written. But when you were talking about The View, I personally think that it's on because it's like the gaping jaw. It just feeds elitism. You know, I feel like they really are all just saying, I am so wonderful and I'm amazing and I'm so smart. So I think yes. that it feeds a particular audience.
Yes. Thanks for the comment. It feeds those who have very high self-esteem. And a very low intellectual prowess.
The white fragility crowd, basically what you're saying.
Yeah. I mean, it feeds the dullards and the idlers.
Yeah.
It feeds the, I don't need to think. I don't need to do anything. This popped into my head. I'm a good person. Yeah. It must be true. Whoopi just told me she thinks the same thing. End of discussion.
Feeds the white guilt.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J this morning, a former state rep and current host of Black and Right. Saturdays, 1 p.m. on these airwaves. John Anthony.
Hey, hey. Thanks, Dan.
John, you had much experience in the K through 12 realm, the combination of being the father of 42 children.
Yes, that's right.
You guys live in a shoe, I understand.
We do.
You have six kids.
Six.
And also being a state legislator, obviously education yeah. is a big state legislative issue, too. And so these local elections, again, we continue to repeat to try to beat the drum. Tuesday, local elections, school board, municipal, township. These are important elections. And we always talk about focused on where you can have influence, where you can have exercise some control over your life. And that's your neighborhood, your community, and by extension, those institutions that are foundational to your neighborhood and your community, like school boards. So we've been profiling a bunch of local races. We're continuing to do so right up and through next Tuesday, April 6th. Today, it's District 211 in the Northwest Burbs. This is high school district, Conant, Fremd, Hoffman Estates, Palatine, Schaumburg. We've got three candidates. We'll take them right in a row who are running for District 211 board. Remember, District 211 got on the map early in the whole trans identitarian ideological battle with a student that sued the school district because they wanted access to a bathroom that was not consistent with their biological sex. And that was fought by a group of District 211 parents against a Vichy identitarian, a Vichy sort of center right, but turned out to be identitarian board and, of course, superintendent, these overpaid superintendents. This should be the predicate question for every person running for school board. What are you going to do to clip the wings of these mainly officious, overpaid superintendents? Right there along with the teachers' unions. So let's get to it. Our first candidate up, District 211 school board, is Kristen Steele. And by the way, all three candidates that we're talking to today are women. If there were not four, like, sensible women engaging in the fight for Western civilization, the fight would already be over. I mean, I don't know where conservative men are in this country, but honestly, The candidates we talked to, the leadership, the work that's being done, from what I see, from my vantage point, it's overwhelmingly women.
I agree.
But I digress. Kristen Steele, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Happy Wednesday. Happy hump day to you all. First, I just want to say I am steel with no E on the end. So just like the metal, strong like steel. So, okay. Yes, I am a mom first and foremost, like you mentioned. I have three kids in the district, not six, not 42. I have three kids. They range in age from second grade all the way through high school. My high school is at Hoffman Estates High School. So I have a long time in the district. I have a lot of skin in the game. And I started, I guess you kind of already mentioned it, this battle back in July with, you know, things weren't looking as they should be looking for getting our kids back in school. And you also mentioned about our superintendents and what's going on there. In July, that oversight that the school board is supposed to have on the superintendent and the representation to the community, the taxpayers and the students, that was put all in the superintendent's hands. She has full decision-making capability and authority on everything as it relates to going back to school,
so,
what she says, what goes.
So an abdication of fiduciary responsibility by the school board, like we saw an abdication of fiduciary responsibility by the General Assembly to the governor. I'm glad to see the consistent thread there. So the basis on which you're running is for what? Is it specific to the performance under COVID, during COVID, or is it something larger?
So it is under COVID. I have to say I would be running for school board had we not been in this awful position that we've all been in for the past year. You know, I started getting involved just prior to the shutdown. You know, what's going on in our district? Things weren't, you know, I was seeing academic inequities, you know, simple things like test prep time and, you know, what's going on at this school isn't necessarily what's going on at that school. And it was just time to get involved. And then we had our pandemic and slowly started, we thought, you know, trying to reopen through the summer and not going back to school full time. That just couldn't be in the cards. So, I held a rally at Hoffman Estates High School, got parents involved, started a Facebook page, returned to in-person learning. And it was clear at that time that the people that I was meeting in the community, that they were looking for change in our school board. And how was that going to happen? And it had to come from, you know, a parent, in my opinion, that is on the ground, in the trenches, working hard and being a part of the community and connecting with the parents. And so that is first and foremost, getting our kids back in school full time. We're still not there yet. Do the kids go to school every day if they have the opportunity? Yes. Are they there full time? No, we're still approximately 160 minutes short a day, a week of school.
Hey, Kristen, one of the things that I've always hated during my time in the General Assembly is the unfunded mandates that are just thrown onto school districts. What do you guys plan on? Are you guys willing to, if an unfunded mandate comes down from Springfield and you know you can't implement it, are you guys willing to buck the system and say to Springfield, we're not implementing this unfunded mandate?
Yeah, well, I can only speak for myself, and I hope that I am a part of a sitting board that will act in the best interest of the needs of the kids in our district. I am fully willing to do that. You know, it's not one size fits all where something is jammed down every district in the state's throat where we must abide. It is, you know, it does come down locally, and we have to look at the details of how that impacts our district and our students.
She is Kristen Steele, candidate for District 211 School Board, District 211. Kristen Steele, she's on the ballot on Tuesday. Kristen, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. And you can find us all. We're all running separately. Hashtag Moms for 211.
Moms for 211. Okay, very good. Thanks, Kristen. Let's move to our next candidate. She is Jessica Hinkle. Again, District 211. Hashtag Moms for 211. Jessica, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Hey. Good morning. So your impetus to run for District 211 school board, what's the big issue? The one thing you're going to do if you're elected or fight for?
Sure. Yeah, I think I can agree a lot with what Kristen said. Back a couple of years ago, I started getting more interested in our local elections, realizing that my property taxes were going up and continuously going up and up and up, and really diving into like what's going into our property taxes, and then realizing that over 70% of our property taxes go to the schools. And that's how I first got involved with why I started getting interested in the school board. And as I started attending some of the meetings, I started recognizing that our school board, we are debt-free, but we have a surplus of money that it just doesn't make sense why we're maintaining it and why we're badgering and beating up our community with overburdening them with our taxes. And so that was the first thing that really kind of pushed me to the idea of running for the board. And then, of course, COVID hit, and, I have a high school freshman at Schaumburg High School, and I noticed his academic career starting to tank by, laying in his bed while he's doing gym class and whatnot. And just being able to, I guess the benefit of COVID is actually being able to listen in on his classes and hear what the classroom, what takes place in the classroom. And it was a little bit eye-opening. And I realized at that point that we need to do a little bit more. We need more parent voices and more student voices on our board. And so that's actually the straw that broke the camel's back to get me to run. So.
Yeah. So what future system or infrastructure would you be willing to put in place? Because I noticed that when the governor basically shut all schools down, he kept saying these are the CDC guidelines. Well, guidelines is not a mandate. It's a guideline is just simply saying, hey, you can follow this if you want, but you don't really have to. And I think throughout the entire school system of Illinois and throughout America, nobody really had anything in place. So what's the system in place so that the governor can't just nilly-willy come in and just shut everybody down? What are your plans for that?
Right. Well, I think specifically in our district, I think we did our community a disservice by putting all the powers into our superintendent's hands. Again, kind of like how you said it earlier, it doesn't make sense for one person to be the sole decision maker for an entire community. And I think by doing so, we really took away the powers of our community and the voices of our community. And what we did by doing that is allowed one person's thoughts and feelings dictate what's going to happen to our students. So first off, if I get on the board, I'm going to push so that we take that sole power away from our superintendent, and it comes back to the board, and we can have a discussion amongst a group of people that are, advocating for our students and for our teachers and for our parents. And that would be my first step, is to get back to this group discussion rather than having a dictatorship.
So. What about the curriculum? You said on the Zoom classes, some of the things you heard were eye and ear opening. What's the problem there?
Yeah, I was just kind of shocked that, maybe it was just due to COVID, but the classroom seemed very lackadaisical. And again, it could have been due to COVID, maybe teachers weren't ready for, being, doing a Zoom class rather than an in-person class. But it seems a very slow pace. And I would honestly say that my freshman at the end of this year, I don't think that he's going to be, I don't consider him a sophomore. I consider him a freshman 0.5. I don't think that he's gotten the education that he should have gotten. And again, it could have been due to COVID, but some of the topics that were discussed were very broad, or it didn't go into the detail that I recall when I was in 211, the details that those classes went into. So I feel that we might be pushing, might be straying away from the core needs of our students and getting them ready for the real world, and focusing on, life skills rather than political thinking. So
Jessica Hinkle, she is also a candidate for District 211 school board. She's on the ballot on Tuesday. Hashtag moms for 211 applies to you too, Jessica.
It sure does. And you can also check out my website at jesshinkle.com. It's J-E-S with one S, hinkle.com.
J-E-S one S, hinkle.com. Thank you for joining us. Appreciate it. Let's move on to our final candidate that we're talking to this morning, District 211 school board candidate, Robbie Volkommer. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Robbie, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. And yes, you are pronouncing it perfectly.
All right. Wonderful. So the basis on which you're running for school board and what about the politics both going on internally in the school system and as well as any politics that's attendant to this campaign, this candidacy, your candidacy and those of your running mates this cycle?
The politics, this whole election process has been very eye-opening to me. I am astounded by the level of corruption at this level for a volunteer school board position. There are a lot of candidates that are treating this nonpartisan election as a partisan election, and it's very concerning to me, getting political endorsements by political parties, besides the amount of tens of thousands of dollars that they're getting funded to them. And then also they're getting the teachers union involved by getting endorsements through them and getting their signs paid for as well. And I believe it's a conflict of interest, and I'm just astounded at the level of corruption at this level. And I can't even imagine the level of corruption that goes on at the state or national level.
Yeah, it's similar. I mean, but it's interesting you point that out. Of course, it's a conflict of interest. They're on both sides of the deal, right? They're backing the people that are going to negotiate their contracts, and vote on their contracts. Obviously, a conflict of interest. But it tells you whose interests are being served, right? Who's politicizing it and who's funneling the money in? School vendors and the teachers union. Yep. That's who the schools are set up to serve. The people that are paying or supporting the candidates, the people who get paid, the adults, the businesses, the vendors, and the teachers union, the teachers by extension. That's what this whole thing is about. And until you have a school board that demands that the schools be child-centered and outcome-focused, that will continue to be the case. And you'll have a school district like Jessica was just telling us that doesn't really resemble what it was like when she went to school there, does it?
Correct. I'm actually a Hoffman Estates High School graduate of 211, and this is not the same playing field or the way schools were back in the day that I recall. And there's also a dangerous trend of steering away from academics, and it's a dangerous pathway that we're on.
Dangerous. Well, steering away from academics in school, that's seems to be counterintuitive, but I guess I'm old school too in that way. I thought that was the point, but I must not be up to speed.
It's not the point today. And I spoke of this last year at a board meeting and cited several examples of where I showed how the schools have not been paying attention and steering away from academics. And I always thought it was the sole purpose and should be the priority of all schools is academics and education and the students. But it doesn't appear to be. Schaumburg High School alone neglected to update their academic scholar wall for 7 years.
Wow.
Hoffman Estates High School doesn't even have an academic scholar wall.
Well, don't want to make people feel bad. Yeah.
Here's my question. One thing I'm learning about a lot of local government, because I've really been paying attention to a lot of local government, is this tax levy. Now, for the past 5 years, District 211 has had a surplus, right? Now,
correct.
The reason being is because they've maxed their tax. They've taken the tax levy to the maximum. What is the moms of for District 211 plan to tackle reducing that? And will that go back to the taxpayers?
Well, I think the moms of, these three moms here, Jessica, Kristen, and myself, are wanting to think outside the box and see what would be the best for the community and the taxpayer and be fiscally responsible. Right now, 211 is operating with over a $30 million surplus, and they just recently had a $17 million land sale. So I think we need to think outside the box and see if there's other possibilities like an abatement or a refund to the taxpayers that, needs to be explored and looked at. And, you know, I can't make those final decisions at this stage of the game, but, right. You know, we're, I know these three moms are definitely willing to consider anything and do their research and homework.
All right, if you guys abate property taxes in a high school district with 12,000 kids, I'm going to put you three on my wall of scholars. How does that sound? Because that would be foundation. That would be a watershed moment in the history of K-12 education in Illinois. So, Godspeed on that. Again, hashtag Moms for 211. She is Robbie Volkhammer, Kristen Steele, Jessica Hinkle. Robbie, any additional information you want to share for more information about your candidacy?
Yeah, you can find me on Facebook. Okay. That's primarily the social media site I use, just Robbie Volkhammer, D211 Board of Education. And I just want to say, to me, a union endorsement is like the fox guarding the chicken coop.
Absolutely. That's exactly what it
Speaking
is.
Speaking your language, Dan.
Robbie, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate all three moms for 211 who joined us. They're on the ballot on Tuesday. Schaumburg, Palatine, Hoffman Estates, wake up! And they joined us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Text to the show, these interviews, these candidate interviews are great, both for giving them the exposure, but also so listeners can hear their normal people. Maybe it will motivate others to participate. That's a good observation, especially the part about, giving them profile. We're happy to do it. But the normal moms, normal candidates, responsible, commonsensical people. And we need a lot more of them engaged than just those three moms into 11. But that's a good start.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan, and in for MEJ this morning is John Anthony.
Hey, hey.
He is the host of Black and Right, Saturdays 1 p.m. on these very airwaves. And I love vintage rants that have present applicability. You ready? Against the backdrop of the latest soon-to-be-proposed spending gambit by the Democrat Socialists and the Biden administration. This is from 2014. Uh-oh. A former MEP from the UK, member of the European Parliament, Godfrey Bloom, in 2014, a touchdown ago, talking about politicians, central banks, spending. Sounds like a topic that would be applicable today, doesn't it?
I'm a baby boomer. I was born just after the war. We've probably had the longest period of peace and prosperity globally, I would say, from that time. I've put a little bit of modest money away so I can hand something down to my family when I pass on, largely because I've never spent more money than I've earned, and I've been prudent, and I've worked moderately hard. Now, it always seems to me as a complete surprise to politicians how countries get in debt. Let me explain, because I don't think you really understand it. It's because politicians consistently spend more money than they raise in taxation, more money than they can possibly raise in taxation, most of which, in point of fact, they actually waste. The reason we're talking about countries which are broke, and they are broke, is because they're ridiculous, ineffective, ignorant politicians consistently spend more money than they can raise. And then they borrow, and they borrow, and worse, they then print money because politicians and their central banks have a machine which prints money. You do that as a private citizen, and it's a criminal offence. You would go to prison for doing that, and politicians and their central banks do it all the time. Let me explain to you that these countries are broke. and they're broke because of their own stupid leadership and politicians. And it's immoral, immoral to ask ordinary taxpayers of any country to pick up the tab for failed politicians and failed banks. They are defaulted. They're broke. For God's sake, let's all of us admit it.
Wow. Refreshing.
Yeah, when Brits get their ire up, it can be very colorful. As Godfrey Bloom was saying, he unfortunately left the MEP, I think, after he struck a journalist or some minor offense. Here's a story last year in America. Chapter 7 bankruptcies down 22%. Chapter 13 bankruptcies, individuals, down 46%. Chapter 11 bankruptcies, commercial, up 29%.
Oh.
Down 22, down 46 on the consumer and individual side, up 29% on the commercial side. But per MEP Bloom, who needs businesses when you've got the government printing press and modern monetary theory mystics to justify running three shifts on that press? And isn't that what we have? For more on the topic, please be joined by Steve Moore, economist, Wall Street Journal columnist, Trumponomics author. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, guys.
Morning. So what's another $2 to $4 trillion for infrastructure on the pyre?
God, I mean, you know, this is really getting dangerous. Yeah, that's why I'm glad you played that tape because, you know, we started – I'll do the math for you very quickly. So we started the year with $1 trillion in the pipeline, remember, from the COVID bill that Trump passed right before he left office. So that was $1 trillion that had not been spent, you know, was for 2021. Then, of course, Biden comes along and says, oh, we need another $2 trillion on top of the $1 trillion, which, of course, everyone knows was completely unnecessary because the economy is opening up on its own now that we're getting the vaccine out there. But they wanted to spend $2 trillion, as you know, about what, 9 to 10% of that had anything to do with COVID. Most of it was just to give away to the groups that made the election with the Democrats possible, the mayors and the unions and so on. And now they come along, and every time I don't even want to open the newspaper anymore or listen to the news because the price tag for this, quote, infrastructure bill keeps getting bigger and bigger. So it's going to be $1.5 trillion, then $2 trillion, then $3 trillion. Now I read yesterday in the Wall Street Journal, oh, their new mantra is go big, right? So now they're saying $4 trillion, and so if my math is right, Ann and John, that's $4 trillion plus $2 trillion plus $1 trillion. That's $7 trillion. this is a fiscal insanity what's going on here. These people are drunk with power. And by the way, the infrastructure bill is – let's stop talking about this as an infrastructure bill. This has nothing to do with infrastructure. It is the Green New Deal. We used to laugh about this, right? We used to laugh at how completely absurd this was. And now they actually are going to implement this stuff. Do you guys remember Solyndra?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Solyndra was that five, just so for people who might not have heard of this before. This was the, you know, we've gone through this before under Obama. Remember, he was going to do the big, all the green stuff, and we're going to have all the shovel-ready green projects. And so we gave $500 million to Solyndra. By the way, that's a rounding error in what Biden is spending, but $500 million is still a lot of money. And it never produced a single kilowatt of electricity. The company went bankrupt, but the people who owned it walked away with $500 million of taxpayer money, and we got fleeced. And I guarantee you, if we do this bill, you're going to not have one Solyndra. You're going to have hundreds of Solyndras with people with boondoggles that the government invests in. One other quick thing. Have you heard this new term that the left is using? They're so good with their rhetoric. They call it social infrastructure. Have you heard that term?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah.
You know what? I had never heard it before until 2 days ago. In fact, I was on a Fox show, and the guy who was debating said, there's a lot of money for social infrastructure. I'm like, what is that? Oh, it's daycare.
Yeah.
It's basically income transfer programs, which, you know, we used to call entitlement and welfare. They are now calling that social infrastructure. So I would guess maybe 20% of the money in this bill is actually infrastructure, bricks and mortar stuff.
But before you even get into the contents of he proposes today, I mean, just sort of a fundamentally and a very simple level is something that's just so telling about the D.C. culture. Biden's $3 to $4 trillion infrastructure plan to be announced Wednesday will be financed by four tax increases worth about $1.8 trillion. $3 to $4 trillion we're going to spend. We're going to finance it with $1.8 trillion. And that's just reported, you know, matter of factly. Like, there's nothing hanky about that. There's nothing, you know, like Monty Python silly about that.
Well, you know, the tax increase is, we're not clear yet whether they're going to try to pass those together or the, you know, separate bills. But yeah, $1.8 trillion doesn't add up to $4 trillion, right?
Right. Common core, the greater sign, the alligator's mouth goes in the direction of the $3 trillion. Yes, right.
Exactly. But look, the tax increase is the worst part of this. I mean, it basically raises our tax on small businesses. It raises tax on American corporations. One of the things I was proud of is, you know, we talked, Dan, you and I talked for years and years and years about this, about how our corporate tax was completely out of whack with the rest of the world. And, you know, we're just seeping capital out of the United States because it was going to, you know, countries with, you know, 15 or 20% corporate taxes when we were at, you know, 38%. And so, you know, Biden wants to bring that rate back up again. It's just going to benefit the Chinese and the Germans. I mean, the big winners in all of this are all the countries we compete with, right? I mean, as Trump would say, they're just laughing behind our back that we're going to massively increase our taxes. Now, Janet Yellen has a solution to that, guys. I don't know if you saw that, but she says that when countries cut taxes, that's a, quote, this is another one of their great euphemisms. It's a race to the bottom.
Yeah.
We're a race to the bottom. We can't let countries cut their taxes, so we're going to penalize other countries for doing what we should be doing, which is cutting their taxes.
Yeah. Hey, Steve, you just stole my thunder with the China thing, but that's okay. but because I was going, that was going to be my point. I mean, who's the bigger
China's
winner?
Gonna love this.
This.
They're going to love this. Yeah.
But I'm
a big winner here.
I'm looking further out. I like to look out because I still don't think we've felt the full effect of what COVID has done to our states, our municipalities, and our country. And I think when you look at on top of the immigration issue that's happening, you're looking at the student loans that you know they want to pay everybody student loan $50,000 or whatever they want to call it. That's the bigger problem that nobody's talking about, and nobody. I mean, what is it with our elected officials that have no foresight in seeing problems on the horizon, or they just don't care? What are your thoughts?
I think what's going on is so Biden has called in all of these left wing historians. I guess that's redundant, left wing historians, but it seems like every historian out there. But you know, so they're. You know, if you do look at, like, the ratings, this always annoyed the hell out of me, but if you look at the ratings of the great presidents, according to these, quote, historians, it's always like Woodrow Wilson, FDR, you know, LBJ, all the presidents who massively spent money and bankrupted their country. One of the greatest myths, I know this is a sidetrack, but I got to say this, probably the single greatest myth that has endured now for nearly 100 years is the mythology that the New Deal was some kind of success.
Yeah.
It wasn't a success. We had 15% unemployment for the first 8 years FDR was in office. That would be like if we had a you know, 15% unemployment rate, you know, 8 years from now. And we said, oh, boy, thank God Joe Biden came in. He really saved the day. And so I don't know how that myth started, but, you know, historians and sociologists and most university professors love big government. So they came into Biden and said, Joe Biden, if you want to be a great president, and he nodded his head, and they said, okay, spend and spend and spend and borrow and borrow and borrow, and you'll go, we'll rank you one of the great presidents of all time. Now, I happen to think, you know, my favorite presidents are presidents like Grover Cleveland and Calvin Coolidge and Ronald Reagan, who cut the budget, not increased it, but that's what we're up against. So Biden thinks he's going to go down in history as one of the greatest presidents. We're going to put him on Mount Rushmore. Because he bankrupted our country.
That's right, because we mythologize government expansion and we demonize people spending their own money. And part of it is to rinse and repeat the facts, the truth, a lot more than we do. For example, on this matter of taxation, since they run around saying, you know, 80% of the benefit of the Trump tax cuts went to the top 2%, that's just a lie. That is untrue. In point of fact, when you put this in context, lowest income workers benefited the most on a percentage basis through the 9% growth in their wages and the 3.5% unemployment. The combination of the two, low income workers benefited the most.
Yeah, and I mean, you're right about those two things. And also, as a percentage of the taxes that they pay, there was a bigger percentage reduction in middle class taxes than there were for the high income people. I mean, the average middle class family got, you know, something like $2,000 a year off their taxes. Now, I know that that's crumbs to,
Nancy Pelosi because she's a she and her husband are, you know, multi-millionaires. But the fact is that's a lot. And by the way, we took millions of people off of the tax rolls at the bottom. And I'm not and necessarily for that. I think everybody should pay some income tax. But we cut taxes so much, a lot of people were down to zero in terms of their taxes. So. I'm frustrated. I mean, I think there's a very dangerous moment for our country, and I hope that, you know, Democrats who are, you know, I have Democratic relatives in the Chicago area who listen to your show, Dan, who voted for Biden, and I think they're in shock. I mean, I don't think anybody knew we were going to get this.
Well, I don't know when Comrade Bernie is running around saying $35 trillion Green New Deal. I'm like, oh, yeah, but yeah, they're probably pretty serious about it. And since it's Bernie policies and Obama staffers, I think you could sort of anticipate what is coming to pass. The question is less about the Democrat socialists; they're gone. And more about, you know, if they name enough swimming pools and bridges after Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, do they get Republicans to flip?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I thought you were going to say the, quote, moderate Democrats. But what we learned from the $1.9 trillion bill, which every single Democrat in Congress voted for,
there are
no moderate Democrats.
Hey, this Manchin.
They're basically what? They're all, yeah. I mean, they're just marching like those Korean soldiers in front of, you know, in robotic fashion. Taking America right over the cliff. I mean, this is a dangerous moment for the country, folks. I mean, we joke around about this, but this will be something that we will spend the next 50 years paying for. You know, as our children and grandchildren are going to pay for this. I mean, bills have to be paid. Debts have to be repaid. This idea that we're acting as if it's all free money. I mean, people, I have friends of mine say, when do I get that free check from the government? You know, the free people. I debate these liberals on some of these shows like Fox, and they say, I make the arguments against it. And they say, well, it's popular, people. And I said, well, obviously it is. I mean, we're America. Americans love free things. If the government's going to say, hey, you just won the lottery, we're going to pay you $1,400, you know, Americans go, yeah, sure, send me the check. I mean, my son came up the other day. I can't wait to get my $1,400 check. I need those new Nike.
He should be grounded. You know? You should ground that son. Ground that boy of yours.
Yeah, well, everybody loves free, especially the millennials. They just, they've spent their whole life getting free stuff.
Yeah, they learned it from the baby boomers. Steve Moore, economist, Wall Street Journal columnist, author of Trumponomics. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Okay, guys. Have a great week. Take
you
care.
Too. And he joined us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560 The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy this morning is former police officer, former state representative, current host of Black and Right, John Anthony. Saturday is 1 p.m. on these airwaves.
Hey, thanks, Dan.
John, great to have you. And Van Jones is a former and current Obama suck toy who leveraged that into being a CNN contributor. And this is what he had to say about the Chauvin trial and what would happen were Derek Chauvin not to be convicted. And I think when he means not convicted, I think that includes if he's only convicted of lesser included charges.
The system is on trial here. The system is on trial. And I can't tell you, people have tried to push away from this, move on from this. Today brought it all back home for tens of millions of people. And if this is considered legal conduct from a police officer, if you can do this in broad daylight, and not go to jail. It will be perceived as open season, telling police officers from coast to coast, you can literally get away with murder in broad daylight. Mm-hmm.
As if that's a police officer's disposition is to see what they can get away with in terms of abusing the constituents they serve. But that's sort of an important premise that you have to understand Van Jones and so many on the defund the police left are starting from. For more on the topic, we're pleased to be joined by former police officer, Tucson, if I recall correctly, co-founder of Blexit and author of the upcoming book, Beaten Black and Blue, Being a Black Cop in an America Under Siege. Brandon Tatum, thanks for joining us again, Brandon. Appreciate it.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, good morning.
What about Van Jones had to say? Is that right?
Yeah, I think Van Jones is, you know, I don't have a lot of respect for Van Jones. I think he flip-flopped his message depending on what CNN want him to talk about or whatever the left want him to talk about. You know, I think the system is not on trial to the average everyday person who have common sense. The system is on trial to these leftist lunatics and BLM and all these activists who want a expected outcome. I think that for me, I want to see justice served, and that means that they're going to have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Derek Chauvin had intent to kill George Floyd in whatever ways that match the description of the statute. And if they cannot reach that burden, then, you know, Derek Chauvin is innocent in the court of law. And if that's the verdict that they reach, then that's what it is. And if he's charged with murder or whatever lesser included charges, then that is also acceptable. I think that, you know, we'll see at the end of this trial, and people should accept whatever comes from this with the understanding that our criminal justice system isn't inherently racist every time, you know, an outcome is goes in a different direction than some it may expect.
That's true. Hey, Brent, I really loved your take on it on the Tatum Report on YouTube and how you were breaking down the differences between the statue and how it read, especially when it came to the unintentional murders. Of them having to prove that Chauvin was trying to commit a felony in the midst of trying to do his job, basically. I thought that was. Do you mind going into that and just because I think that's the most important part. Because as long as the defense is able to create doubt, I think you're 1,000% correct. Chauvin walks free.
Correct. I mean, one of the charges, at least the highest charge that they have, is second degree murder. Some people believe that, you know, they may be misunderstanding second degree murder is normally intentional murder without premeditation. But in this sense, there's a subsection 2 of that statute says that, you know, it's unintentional, but committing a felony crime or intentionally committing a felony crime in the midst. And I just think that that's going to be a hard burden to prove, given the fact that George Floyd was under intoxicated substances, deadly substances, and also he was combative, he was irrational, and Derek Chauvin was potentially performing a maneuver that's trained and operated by that police department. So it's going to be very difficult to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yeah, speaking of the training, because that's one of the defenses that will be raised in addition to George Floyd being under the influence and what was the proximate cause of his death. The defense is going to challenge that. They're going to challenge based on the training, too, saying that knee to the neck is something that Minneapolis police officers are taught as a way to maintain an unruly suspect. But I suppose the problem, it would seem to me as a layman, that Chauvin has and the defense has is, you know, at some point there needs to be a reasonable man standard. And even if that was your training, the idea that you would maintain that posture when it's clear or should have been clear to the reasonable person that George Floyd was in medical distress is a problem.
And I agree 1,000%, and that's probably why he's on trial now, is because to the naked eye, it looks that it was irrational for him to have him on the ground that long and not render aid and all of the above. But what it's going to come down to is two things, in my personal opinion, is that get the methamphetamine and fentanyl, which he was, it's inevitable, I think, that at this point, with the amount of fentanyl that he ingested, he was going to die, or he was on his way to death, even if Chauvin never came to the scene. So that's going to be something that's going to play. Was the cause of death actually the fentanyl and methamphetamine? And then the other, proof that the defense is going to have to raise is, how is the maneuver functioned? Not what it looks like,
right,
but how is it actually functioned? And I know on the police department, you know, we have maneuvers similar to that, is that people may observe it and think that we're holding 100% of our body weight on our leveraged knee, and that's not what's happening. You know, we kind of have a balance between the knee and the heel so that you don't put pressure, although you control. So if they can prove, the defense can prove that, hey, he wasn't putting pressure on George Floyd's neck. He was just acting out because he was high on drugs, and Chauvin was having a level of restraint. It just looked bad. And that, if the defense could prove that, I think that would create reasonable doubt, and Chauvin may not be charged with any of these crimes.
Yeah, and Brandon, I think when this first happened, I wanted to go and see what you were going to say. And initially, when it first happened, I think a lot of people forget that 8 minutes and 49 seconds is just a portion of it. People forget everything that happened from the beginning because as we're trained as cops, the totality of the circumstance, what's everything that happened at that moment? You know, I mean, going up to the car, first of all, the fake $20 bill, going to the car, trying to swallow the fentanyl and the drugs, putting it in his mouth. Nobody even knew anything about that. I speak more to that because the totality of the circumstance is really what it's all going to come down to as to determine if Chauvin and I think the other three are going to walk, period, because I don't see how there's any way that you can charge these guys with any crime, in my opinion. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, 100% I agree. You know, you're not charging anybody else with a crime. I mean, they were doing their job. And people do need to look at the totality of the circumstances, because if you just look at him crying for his life on the ground, it can be very compelling, but the jurors are not going to just watch that 8 minutes or 9 minutes. They're going to see the whole thing,
right,
which you're going to see George Floyd's mental state, him claiming that he was claustrophobic when he was in a patrol car, yet he was in the driver's seat of another car full of people. And so it kind of kills his argument of his reliability. Also, Derek Chauvin was incredibly kind to George Floyd at the very beginning of this call. So it's going to be very hard to see Chauvin participating or acting towards George Floyd with respectful, kind manner, and then all of a sudden he become this vicious killer that wants to see George Floyd die and go to hell. You know, so
right,
it's going to be very difficult for the jury to just focus on this one situation when you have a combative George Floyd, when you have an irrational George Floyd, and then I'm guaranteed they're going to bring a person who's going to testify to the reaction that a person will have from drugs,
yes,
that are so fatal, like fentanyl and, yes, even crazy drugs like methamphetamine.
Brandon Tatum, I wanted to get your opinion on another Law and Order matter, particularly because you were in Tucson as a police officer. Listen to what Border Patrol agent Oscar Escamilla had to say about what he has encountered with these children coming across the border and then being taken into federal custody.
You know, and I told the congressional delegation the same thing, right? We were going to send her to the hospital. And as I got closer to her, I noticed that she couldn't speak. And I asked the medical staff what happened. And the reason she was going to the hospital because she had gotten gang raped. And the reason that she couldn't speak was because she had lost her voice in the process while she was getting raped. Those things hit hard. These kids cross by themselves. Obviously, the parent pays a fee to the smuggler. The cartel member or the smuggler at this point will bring the kid over. We'll bring him to the river. We'll hand him over to the raft, we'll place them in a raft and say, okay, go. When you get to the other side, they'll explain to them, there's gonna be an officer, they'll explain what we wear and tell them, turn yourselves into them. These kids, some of them, will tell you the different stories. They'll tell you that they don't have their parents. There's a little girl that I talked to a little while ago, she said that she had lost her mom and that she doesn't have a father. So she's coming into this country because her uncle is going to be the sponsor. So they want to take this little girl is going into the States. And I asked her, what state are you going to? What's your final destination? She said, I don't know. All I know is that it snows there. That's all I know.
And what's happening at the border in the context of a projection that as many as a million migrants are expected to be at the U.S.-Mexico border this year. Brandon, your comment on the border?
Oh yeah, it's horrifying that our politicians can't resolve this issue. And the thing about it is that they're playing politics and they don't really care about the lives of these individuals. You know, what kind of life are you going to have, especially during a pandemic? You're going to come to America. You cannot speak English. It's going to be almost impossible for you to actually get a job and have a way of life. You come into a foreign country where you know nobody. Many of these children who are coming over are unaccompanied. I don't know why people aren't getting it at this point. And then to travel over. I mean, people act like, you know, that God somehow picked these kids up and dropped them off right at the border in a safe space. That's not what happens. They have a trick, and they're getting raped. They're getting abused. Women are getting abused when they come over here. I mean, these people are not, you know, fine individuals. And this is a coordinated effort by the cartel in Mexico. And I don't understand how our country is leveraging power to the cartel by accepting these people and telling them to come over here and we'll give you amnesty. We can't even take care of people in L.A. We can't even take care of people in the inner city. How in the world, and I almost want to cuss mm-hmm. at the thought of this, how in the world are we expecting to take care of millions of people who can't add value to this country, that don't even know where they're headed, don't even know people in this country? I mean, we're doing them an injustice. I think that what we should do, we should close our border, protect our border, and fix our immigration process. So therefore, people don't have to sneak over here and pay for coyotes. They can come over here legally if that's what our country wants to do, and we can make sure we get them assimilated into our country so they can have opportunities and rights like American citizens do, instead of them flying under the radar, getting raped and abused. And in many cases, law enforcement is something that they're afraid of when they get over here in the States. So when they do get raped on this side, or if they get abused on this side or being mistreated, they're not going to call the police because they're afraid they're going to get deported. That's not the way people should live in this country.
He is Brandon Tatum. He's a former Tucson police officer, co-founder of Blexit, and author of the upcoming book, Beaten Black and Blue, Being a Black Cop in an America Under Siege. Brandon, thanks so much for joining us again. Appreciate it.
God bless you. Thank you.
All right. And he joined us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan. And in for Amy this morning is John Anthony, former state rep, former police officer, current host of Black and Right Saturdays, 1 to 3 p.m. on our airwaves here.
Hey, hey.
Hey, hey, John.
That went by fast.
Okay,
good Lord.
Goes by fast.
Yes.
Got so much work to do, you know. And when you don't really feel like it's work, it just flies by because it's so enjoyable.
Good point.
That's what people often say about my company. Yeah, exactly. That is a punchline. All right, so here's the thing, or here's the question. I love the comparison that was made by our friend John Tamney. Are we all on North Sentinel Island in America now? Well, before we get to an explanation of that metaphor, one guy who's not going to North Sentinel Island, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis.
So there was never under discussion any mandates to take vaccines. We will not have COVID vaccines mandated in Florida. The flip side of that, though, with these vaccine passports is it's completely unacceptable for either the government or the private sector to impose upon you the requirement that you show proof of vaccine to just simply be able to participate in normal society. You want to go to a movie theater? Should you have to show that? No. You want to go to a game? No. We're going to go to a theme park? No. So we're not supportive of that. I think it's something that people have certain freedoms and individual liberties to make decisions for themselves. I also wonder, it's like, okay, you're going to do this, and then what, give all this information to some big corporation? You want the fox to guard the hen house? I mean, give me a break. I think this is something that has huge privacy implications. It is not necessary to do.
John Tamney is the editor of RealClearMarkets.com, director of the Center for Economic Freedom at FreedomWorks, and the author of the new book, When Politicians Panicked. And I got a signed copy because, you know, John digs me. John, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We're all on North Sentinel Island now. Explain your piece at AIER, American Institute for Economic Research, which I enjoyed so much.
Well, many listeners remember 2 years ago when John Allen Chow, the Christian missionary, ventured to North Sentinel Island. It's an island off of India, and its people migrated there 50,000 years ago. And it's the most isolated island on Earth. No one knows how many people live there. No one knows the language. And this missionary showed up and was riddled with arrows shot from bows. Now, why did they kill him so quickly? Because if he had gotten close to their people, he would have killed them all. And he would have because he would have brought flu, chickenpox, all the things that we are immune to in the modern world that they've never been exposed to. And so it's merely a reminder that this notion that you can hide, that you can somehow isolate yourself, and in doing so make yourself better or healthier, is laughable. In fact, it robs you of the very exposure necessary to get through life healthily.
So, clearly the message about lockdowns, although, you know, in big cities, the lockdowners, big cities, you know, what happens there is mainly people still just kill each other. So this would be if the tribe there was killing each other, which they're clearly not. So it may turn out that the North Sentinelese are more sophisticated than us in the modern world in some respects. But with respect to the lockdowns, I mean, your reaction to the lockdowns that persist, the predictions of doom and gloom with respect to the variants, the slow walking back to schools in New York, in Chicago, elsewhere. And this says just more good news continues to come online with respect to vaccines. Today, Pfizer, 12 to 15-year-olds, 100% effective. And yet the lockdown or the slow walk to normalization persists.
Yeah, it's just tragic. Look, freedom on its own is a virtue. I always stress to people that I would be against lockdowns, even if you could prove to me what's not true, that a lack of lockdowns associated with more deaths. I just don't believe in taking away freedom. But the genius of it is it goes beyond that. Economic growth is easily the biggest enemy of death and disease. Think back to the 19th century when if you were born then, you had as good of a chance of dying as living. That if you broke your hip, you were going to die. That if you got tuberculosis or pneumonia, you were going to die. It was a pretty brutal time to be alive. And what's changed is economic growth. Economic growth produced the resources necessary for doctors and scientists to come up with ways to cure what used to kill us so readily. And so the idea that you take away freedom and use economic desperation as your virus mitigation measure defies basic common sense. And we've been talking about this for a while, you and I and Amy have. It's a tragedy.
Yeah. John, I recall whenever we got some type of virus or illness, my family would all bring us all together so that everybody can get it and get it over with. I call for herd immunity the very first time. But I want to talk about you think back 2019, we have China on the ropes. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I've despised the QAnon type, all those type of things. But you look at what was happening in America. You look at what was happening in the world, the economic. I mean, we were just on the rise. And then all of a sudden, the virus hits. And some have said it's come from Wuhan, the lab. And now there's a big back and forth debate on did it come from a bat or did it come from the lab? I happen to think it came from a lab. I happen to think this was a biological attack on America from China. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, the first thing is I'd say I totally agree with you about families. That's historically what families did is when someone got an illness, they brought all the kids together to get it out of the way. And so you're right. Herd immunity is as old as the hills. It's what people have always done. About China, I would tend to disagree, and let me explain why. For one, if this is the virus they came up with, boy, what are we afraid of? Because it's one that the New York Times has consistently acknowledged is most associated in a death sense with very, very old and sick people in nursing homes. And so kind of a meek virus they came up with. But beyond that, let's never forget that our prosperity is what enables China's. If the U.S. economy implodes, China's economy will implode simply because their wealth is a consequence of them having access to the biggest market in the world, the U.S. And I would add in reverse that we're relying on China's economic growth. Apple sells a fifth of its iPhones in China. GM sells more cars there than it does in North America. It's the second largest market for Nike, for McDonald's. I don't buy that the Chinese would think that they would gain from destroying the country that is the source of their wealth.
Let's talk about a couple other economic matters, particularly in the area of wand waving. Everybody today is focused on this $2-4 trillion spending gambit that Biden is going to unveil in Pittsburgh. But something else he's been doing quietly on a small scale, building up to probably something on a larger scale, since this is the disposition of his party, and that is student loan forgiveness. Collectively, Biden at present has canceled $2.3 billion of student loans for about 110,000 student loan borrowers, most recently for persons, some persons with disabilities, and there's not no real breakdown on that either. I'd like to see that, but setting that aside for a second, $2.3 billion for 110,000 student loan borrowers, but of course, the Bolshevik Bernie crowd, Elizabeth Warren and others want this to be on a massive scale, like all $1.7 trillion worth of accumulated student debt, not to mention free college or something, free college for certain people going forward. What's your view on this aspect of the wand waving as policymaking?
Well, you don't solve an economic contraction born of big government and central planning with more central planning. Look, all government spending is the politicians arrogating to themselves the right to allocate resources that otherwise would be allocated by the private sector. And so invariably, all it is we're reaching into one set of pockets to put it into another set of pockets. There's no economic growth, but now there's an incentive, I suppose, for people to take on even bigger debt going to college because they have a reasonable supposition that instead of having to pay it off eventually, that the taxpayers will pay it off. And so it's immoral. It has nothing to do with growth, and it speaks to a bigger problem. When governments spend, that's Nancy Pelosi and Bernie and Mitch McConnell and others allocating the economy's resources. Central planning that fails in total also fails in a limited sense. Why would we go that route?
Mm-hmm. And so thinking about what has been proposed and what is being advanced, including on the tax side, increasing corporate rates, increasing individual rates in the upper brackets, increasing capital gains rates, particularly in long-term capital gains. I mean, you're looking potentially at if all that were to come to pass, a major market correction, maybe towards the end of this year, the beginning of 2022. I wonder, again, not to be conspiratorial, if, you know, sort of crashing the market and continuing to run the printing press is an economic strategy by the left, Cloward Piven style almost.
Well, there I suppose I'm a little bit more optimistic because, as we discuss a lot, markets anticipate. They don't wait for the result. And so the fact that markets have been relatively buoyant for quite some time, I think, is a signal to what you allude. Yeah, they're talking a lot about capital gains hikes and corporate tax hikes and everything, but how much of that will they get? It's very much a divided Congress, thank goodness, right now. It's basically down the middle. Senate is basically down the middle. We knew they were going to get this spending plan, the $1.9 trillion. That was going to happen whether it was Biden in office, it was going to happen whether Trump was in office. Do I think it was correct? No, but it was going to happen either way. Beyond that, it's going to be very difficult for the Democrats to do any major policy changes simply because they don't have the votes for it. Again, thank goodness for that. Divided government's good.
He is John Tamney, editor of RealClearMarkets.com, director of the Center for Economic Freedom at FreedomWorks, and the new book you want to pick up, When Politicians Panicked, just released this week. John, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And you joined us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer.